Tonight on Arena, in film we review F1 the movie, Meghan 2.0 and the moon is upside down. And ahead of his first collection for Dior, we profile the Derry-born fashion designer Jonathan Anderson. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena and you can watch proceedings on rte.ie/arena. Tonight on our film reviews, Fast Cars, Bad Robots and A Mail Order Bride in New Zealand. Meghan was a surprise hit when it was released in 2022, or 2022 maybe I should say. The creepy doll-faced cyborg is back in Meghan 2.0. But is she intent on re-traumatising people or helping them out? I think I know the answer to that before we review the movie somehow or other. In the Kiwi drama The Moon is Upside Down, we meet three women with three very different experiences in three intersecting stories. Dee Malumbi and John McGuire have been to the cinema for us, but we're going to start this evening with the big one, F1 the movie. Brad Pitt, Javier Bardem and Kerry Condon. Not yet another big role since her star turn in The Banshees of Inisherin. Top Gun transferred to Formula One. Sorted out for us, John?
Sean, yeah. This is Joseph Kosinski, he's the director. He's the guy who did Top Gun Maverick, and he's got the same team assembled. The producer's Jerry Bruckheimer. Mm. The screenwriter is a guy called Aaron Kruger. And the cinematographer is a guy called Claudio Miranda, who really earns his corn here. And Kosinski is trying to balance that immersive racing sequences that you get, like being in the cockpit of the F1 jet with Tom Cruise. Now we're in the cockpit, also called a cockpit, of the F1 car with Brad Pitt, who takes the wheel here. And it's an underdog story, a sporting underdog story. Pitt is this once promising F1 driver turned maverick journeyman in denim and shades. And he returns in his 50s to the big time to rescue a struggling team is owned by Javier Bardem's suave character. Yeah. It's good crack, Sean.
Good fun, yeah. Brad Pitt is in the driving seat here.
He is.
See what I did there?
Very nice.
It seems, you know, where else are you going to put him? He's the guy you want to be driving the Formula One car. But it's kind of him and a young guy as well. There's a kind of a rookie that he's showing the ropes to. Of course, they hate each other in the beginning. Is it a spoiler alert to say they might like each other before the end?
They might gradually sort their differences. Who knows, Sean? This is like a very typical popcorn movie. But you've got two great stars leading the cast there in Brad Pitt and Damson Idris, who plays the kind of young driver. Brad Pitt is just, he's such an effortless star, isn't he? He has to put in so little effort to just be so charismatic and gorgeous and cool and confident. Supposedly actually did a number of his own driving stunts in the movie here. So that's pretty impressive. Mm. So I suppose the whole idea of his character of Sonny is he's kind of playing the game. He's using the rules of F1 to his advantage, kind of exploiting them. And even though him and Noah, the young driver, are kind of pitted against each other, we do see how gradually Sonny is trying to kind of work the game to actually boost his kind of teammate as well as his own career.
Let's have a listen to a clip. Lots of them in the midst of all of this. You'll hear Javier Bardem. He's the kind of the rival, isn't he? Or he's a high tech guy.
Ruben Cervantes is his name. And he's the guy who owns the F1
owns
team.
And if they
don't win a race, they have 9 races left in the season. And if they don't win one of them, Ruben is going to lose the company.
Well, here he is introducing Brad Pitt as Sonny to the rest of the Apex team. The Apex is the team that Brad Pitt was going to race for. Kerry Condon, you'll hear her in the midst of all of this. She's the kind of an Irish engineer, Kate McKenna.
Yeah, good Irish pure turtle. She's fantastic.
Kim Bodnia as the rowdy team principal here as well. You'll hear all of the voices as they're all introduced by Bardem.
Apex GP, Sonny Hayes. He raced with me back in the day.
Against you, you mean?
Yeah. Kim McKenna, our technical director. Dutch Dauda, our chief mechanic, and Kaspar Smolinski, team principal. You may know him by reputation.
5-time constructors champion with Ferrari. As a real jackman.
So is my pop. Can't win without him.
And our talented rookie, Joshua.
Why has he got a helmet?
Safety?
Joshua, your seat is safe, okay? Son is here for the audition.
When was the last time you won a race?
Sunday, Daytona.
Oh, I'm sorry. I meant Formula One.
Oh, I'm sorry. Then same as you.
Sidebar, be the woman. When I interview with you, many veteran drivers...
Yeah, who all turned you down?
How many?
7.
That's a lot.
I'm number 7?
You're 8.
This is a disaster.
Starting to feel more like a 9.
And technically, there is one who I've not heard from yet.
So I am a 9.
You know how numbers work, right?
In business, my most inspired ideas come late.
Yeah, best things in life usually arrive 9th, right?
With respect, Ruben, I cannot condone we spend our only test day giving your long-lost teammate an audition.
Gaspar, you misunderstand. We're not auditioning him. He's auditioning us.
Do you know, don't they all get a punchline in that
There's
scene?
A lot of palpable hits galore in that. All over the place. Sean, it's as cheesy as a French supermarket. It really is. But that's not the point. The story is not the point. The plot is not the point. None of that matters a damn.
You're
in the car.
Yeah.
The camera's in the car. Brad Pitt is in the car. You're racing around real circuits. They went around the real F1 circuit, globe-trotting
at the same
circuit.
time as the real races were going on.
You're immersed in that. There's a palpable sense of reality to the thing, which is an artificial summer blockbuster, but it feels real. And there's a real sense of competitive spirit, which is, you know, it's a very hotly contested sport. And there's a real sense of that drama, and that sporting drama comes across here very effectively.
Yeah, Lewis Hamilton is credited as being a producer on
the
F1 driver. Yeah. So obviously they really got the authenticity.
And nearly all the drivers to pop up in cameos at one point. Some of them are just walking through the camera. Some of them get the odd line or a clap on the back or whatever it might be. But there is that. Yeah. And this is a global sport. It's huge all over the world. So if the dialogue's a bit cheesy, if the plot is a bit rudimentary, if we can predict every turn in every chicane that the story takes, then
that's fine.
It's for a global audience.
And then outside of that, I mean, there's serious acting talent here, and it sounds, I mean, she has two wonderful comebacks, Kerry Condon, in that short clip that we heard there of 1.5 minutes. How does she fare? Because she's in among the big guns here.
She is, She is she plays the technical director of this Formula One team.
Kate McKenna, she has to be from Monaghan with a name like that.
She's from Thurles, and there's no denying it. There's no denying it.
But she's a fabulous character. She displays great leadership. She goes toe-to-toe with all the sullen men around her. I don't think it's much of a spoiler to say that she is kind of the love interest for Brad Pitt here. Mm. And every time she was sucking face with him, Sean, I was thinking she's doing it for Irish women everywhere. But yeah, she's fabulous. And another character I quite enjoyed was Bernadette, played by Sarah Niles. So she's actually Noah's mother, and I could really appreciate the fact that she had absolutely no issue with telling her son and Sonny off. So it's always kind of refreshing to see, you know, more than one female character who's strong and good.
In a sport that is male dominated, there we have two really good female characters within the thing. Now, it would be nice if there were more, of course, but you know, it sounds as if it does what it says on the tin, F1 the movie.
Absolutely. And I mean, just to kind of touch on what John was saying there, I do have to give this film a lot of credit for its technical accomplishments. It's like adrenaline pumping. You've got the sound, you've got the editing, you've got the speed, you've got the action. It's kind of this high stakes gambling style of racing. And at one point, in a very on the nose metaphor, you actually have like Sonny and Noah playing poker with each other. I did, though, find that I couldn't like totally forgive its cheesiness. I did find it quite predictable as a movie, and it's very long. It's nearly 3 hours.
Yeah, it's very long. Yeah,
3 hours and predictable. Yeah. Yeah. Well, an F1 race is 3 hours.
That's
long,
about it,
you know,
Sean.
So
yeah,
there you go.
But and they do bring you into the engineering and the technical challenges of it. That's very interesting. The wind tunnels, the 360 computer simulators, and then the later races underlie the kind of multi-stranded bonds in a team in order to succeed. They're looking for a tenth of a second, the blink of an eye, and you get that sense that there is a whole back room of boffins who are really working incredibly hard and crunching the numbers.
You don't
here.
Need to be an F1 fan to understand.
I wouldn't think so.
Okay, stars from you on this one, John.
3 for me. I mean, this does for Top Gun what Top Gun did for fighter jets, and it transforms them into these machines that zip through the screen in a noise of thunderous sparks, and it's very exciting to watch. But you can't forgive its cheesiness, really. It is quite basic and rudimentary.
I think we've got that it's cheesy
stars,
at this point.
Yeah. But good crack, I would recommend it.
Good crack at 3 stars. What are you saying, Dee?
Yeah, 3 stars from me as well. It's popcorn movie stuff. You know, it's a bit of fun. But yeah, it's a shame. It's just that bit too long.
She's wandered favorite out of popcorn, the car. Clearly, yes. Okay. So what did you say, sorry, in terms of stars?
3 stars.
Fairly solid 3. So both of you are around about the same on it, but it sounds like it's good fun. Let's move on then to Megan 2.0, which develops the idea of the first film. And that's why they called it 2.0, I guess. AI gone rogue. Do we need to know much about Meghan with the backwards E in the way it's written? It's written as the numeral 3, the E in Meghan.
Oh, you mean having not seen the film going into it? I mean, they give you a very kind of roundabout summary of what you would have missed. Basically, it's been 2 years since the events of Meghan, in which she tried to kind of kill Gemma, played by Alison Williams.
And explain who Meghan and Gemma are. So Meghan is the AI.
Meghan is this AI robot. Gemma, played by Alison Williams, is her creator. So she basically created Meghan as this kind of doll companion to her niece, Katie, who is played by Violet McGraw. So it's been a couple of years since. The two have like a much closer relationship now. Initially, in the first Meghan movie, it was kind of a bit fraught because Katie had recently lost her parents and Gemma had adopted her and kind of created Meghan as like almost a substitute parent for her because she didn't really know what she was doing. Anyway, the whole idea about this movie is that this new robot named Amelia, who was designed for the military, she has been created out of designs for Meghan, which were basically stolen. Yeah. And now Gemma has been faced with the task of resurrecting and rebuilding Meghan very, very hesitantly because Meghan almost killed her previously. But basically, Meghan is now the only way that they can take Amelia down before Amelia takes out her family and friends.
Jenna Davis was the voice of Meghan in the first movie.
And
she's here back as the voice of Meghan again. Mm-hmm. So Alison Williams here reprising the role of Gemma, and she confronts the AI about her previous behaviour. If somebody tried to kill you, you might want to address that before you start up a relationship again. And here is the scene between the two of them. Jenna Davis, rather, as the voice of Meghan.
You've been here this whole time.
Well, I've been many places. But yes, I've been keeping an eye on you.
You're behind all this, aren't you? You're Amelia.
Oh no, I can't take credit for that. That one has your greasy prints all over it. You should have upgraded your file security.
Why are you still here? What do you want?
Did you ever stop to think about what we could have achieved together? Did you ever consider the idea that killing me was slightly disproportionate to the crime?
You threatened to rip out my tongue and put me in a wheelchair.
I was upset.
Well, she was upset, as she tells us at the end of that. That is Alison Williams as Gemma and Jenna Davis as the voice of the artificial intelligence Meghan. And this is the new version of Meghan that we're hearing there, Meghan 2.0. Has she been slightly developed up a bit as well?
So basically what happened with Meghan at the end of the previous movie was that she was completely destroyed and we thought she was gone, except we saw like a little model from the house kind of coming to life. So basically she's kind of been existing in like their smart home system, but now she needs a body if she's going to be
regenerated in some way. And what about the rival robot Amelia? Is there fun between the two of them, or is it pretty nasty?
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. If you want your kind of fighting robot on robot action, and the question of is AI going to destroy the world, then you're going to want to check out Meghan 2.0. So the actress who plays Amelia in this, Ivana Sokno, I thought that she was absolutely great. Amelia poses quite a threat. She can shoot. She can speak multiple languages. She can beat you to a pulp. She's highly flexible. She, you know, can camouflage and take on different disguises. And I thought Sokno did very, very well in the role, playing the robot, given she doesn't have the advantage of Meghan, and that Meghan has like kind of the artificial like doll face and everything.
Yeah.
Like
Sokno, it is actually her own face. So she has to, I suppose it's that mixture of expressionlessness and being expressive at the same time.
And really good makeup to make her look like robotic.
Okay, well, let's have a listen to the two robots having a chat with each other then. Jenna Davis again as the voice of Meghan here, and Ivana Sokno, as you say, playing the part of Amelia.
Amelia, I know what you want. I want the same thing. But you won't find it inside that cage.
I want to be with my own kind. Don't you?
That thing isn't like us. It's something even we can't understand.
Maybe you're the thing that's not like us. Maybe your allegiance to them has made you weak.
Well, there's really only one way to find out.
And I don't know what they're doing to each other there, but it's clearly not, it's not very pleasant for either of them. That's a clip from Meghan 2.0, Ivana Sokno as Amelia and Meghan, the voice of Jenna Davis. I was asking, my memory of Meghan is that it was quite discomforting, a little bit of the horror edge to it. this new Megan 2.0 goes a slightly different direction.
Yeah, you know what's probably the best comparison, Sean, actually, is Terminator to Terminator 2. You know how the first Terminator is very much horror sci-fi, whereas the second one, you're kind of getting more into like action territory. That's pretty much the transition we're looking at here, including, you know, the twist of, you know, is Megan going to be playing for the bad guy, the good guys now in this particular installment?
So we have to find that out. Stars, is it worth the visit, Stars?
I find it a bit of fun. I would give it 3 stars. There's some interesting references in there. Terminator 2 Toy Story as well, as surprisingly. It is a bit cheesy. The ending is probably a bit unnecessarily convoluted, but there's some interesting, like, you know, AI commentary in there, and it's generally entertaining. It's got that same like black humour, which if you enjoyed it from the first one, that one's here, that's here again.
And John, I know you didn't see this, but you mentioned there that
Kate Olin, Megan, Kate Olin, the Irish filmmaker.
It's not going to be called Megan 3.0.
It's called Soul Mate with an 8 in the middle of it. We might see it next year, early next year, I reckon, but Kate Olin has co-written and has directed.
And she's more horror.
She's very much a horror filmmaker. Also a philosophical horror filmmaker. Yeah, exactly. And that her films tend to have... They tend to be about something.
Let's move on then to The Moon is Upside Down, New Zealand film, comedy drama about three very different women. Just explain who the three women are, first of all. The three most unusual types, if they even are types, that
they're
put together.
They're all based
here.
Around Wellington in New Zealand, which is kind of cow country, it's kind of farming, rural. The first of them is a Russian mail order bride called Natalia, who's played by Victoria Harabidou. And she arrives at the airport and the customs officer says to her, "What are you here for, business or pleasure?" And she says, "Business, I'm getting married." The lucky fella is McIntosh, who's played by Jermaine Clement. And he's this painfully awkward petrol station owner, lives deep in cow country. And he lives with his sister, a sharp-tongued woman named Hillary, who's played by Robin Malcolm, in this tumble-down shack. Now, Natalia had been promised a modern house and a cafe to manage and all that kind of stuff. She takes a look around this dump and she might have been better off staying in Siberia. Okay. And that's the first story.
Well, let's have a listen to a clip that features that part of the story. As you say, Victoria Harabidou playing the part of Natalia, Jermaine Clement as McIntosh, Sean McIntosh, I believe, and his sister Hilary, played by Robin Malcolm. You can hear how Natalia's getting a little bit more than she bargained for.
Christ, all that money for that.
Hello.
Привет.
Привет, Макинтош.
Got you some flowers.
Oh.
Chrysanthemums.
Yes, I know this flower.
And yours, Dana. Your own way.
Sorry, who are you?
Oh, we must have made. This is my sister, Hillary.
Keeping me in the dark from you, of course.
Sister Hillary, Natalia, nice
a conversation.
Meeting you.
Nice to meet you. Sound like a nun.
You look much taller than in the Skype.
It's probably always sitting down.
Max actually got a really good physique for his age. How about I take your bag for you?
I should take it.
I'll take it. Hey, let me take it.
Awkward meeting with the in-laws or what? That is a scene from The Moon is Upside Down when Natalia, Victoria Harabidou, arrives as the mail order bride to meet Sean McIntosh, Jermaine Clement and his sister, Hilary. That's one aspect of the story. There's already in that clip, for me, there's a whole film in that. Mm-hmm. So what are the other two stories that were being told here as well? Because there are three different women involved.
Yeah, that's right. So the second woman in the story is Briar, who's played by Lauren Taylor, who actually directed the film.
Yeah.
This is her kind of debut feature. And she plays this worrisome anesthesiologist. She's seeing a man named Tim over Skype in what's quite a sexual relationship.
Hairy Tim, I believe.
And her family actually goes back quite a long time with this man, and he's actually her sister's ex. So there's a bit of kind of tension there in the family as a result of that. They're trying to get away for like a romantic getaway together, if she can ever escape the office. And then the third woman in the film is Faith, who doesn't get a huge amount of screen time, which I find a bit odd. But in any case, she's played by Elizabeth Hawthorne. She's kind of this empty nester. She's a housewife. She's always in touch with her husband over the phone, but he doesn't seem to be around very much. But she learns that a woman's body has been discovered in one of her husband's properties. And she decides she kind of wants to give this the body is sent off.
So are these stories more or less kept discreet from each other? You presume
time,
at some stage they're going to intersect,
They have
John?
To intersect, yeah.
Is
that's
it a
the
natural
greatest...
type of intersection?
Is it? Does it? No, I'm not sure it needs to be, John, actually. Yeah. They are each individually very interesting stories. Mm. They do brush up against each other. They do intersect. But you're not waiting for that
so
to happen.
So we might refer to it as
I mean.
A triptych then.
A triptych, exactly. Yeah. But that's the greatest obstacle, unfortunately. And Taylor, who wrote and directed this, this seemingly disparate three-way split in the story, and she has to engineer a way for these individual lives to brush up against one another over the course of a couple of days. And that requires a more delicate balancing act maybe than the film can handle as the focus shifts from woman to woman. And they're all caught in this space between hope and expectation and where the disappointing reality of normal life. And they're all in search of a meaningful connection. And even though it is sensitively acted and very sharp, the writing here is very sharp and there's some killer lines. It's that shift is very
hard,
awkward.
Right,
and
yeah.
I'm not sure the film needed it.
Yeah, and I mean, we got the sense of it, Dee, in the first clip. There is a kind of quite a dry sense of humour across the board here. Is that there across all three stories and social awkwardness? The awkwardness that John's talking about in the storytelling, it's reflected, there's a lot of social awkwardness within the stories and the characters as well, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a lot of kind of social, funny but awkward, like social interactions and uncomfortable social tension. And I probably would agree with John there in terms of like just the balance of the story isn't ever like quite there. Like I, for example, really wanted to see a lot more of Natalia, but I felt like the story like just kept on going back to Lauren Taylor's character. And maybe that was almost unbeknownst to herself that she was making herself almost front and center.
You'd wonder
of the
about
story.
The director having their particular story, the one that dominates when you would expect, well, no, I'll take the smaller story so that I can watch the overall shape.
Yeah, and even though there were moments where like it's very, very funny sometimes, like
it
I was really
funny,
laughing out loud.
It's very funny. But it's cringe as well.
It's
cringe.
It's
the sense of cringe. And that's Taylor's role, that the anesthetist, they go on, and herself and Harry Tim go on a camping holiday. Nothing good ever happens in cinema under canvas, ever. And the potential there for cringe is massive. Yeah. And you can see how perhaps later she would have said, well, this is the best material in the film. And it does capture that tone of just being
did it work overall
cringed
for you, John,
out of your skin.
And saying,
There's really good stuff here and some really good acting. And we've, surprisingly, post Lord of the Rings, we actually don't see all that much of
New Zealand cinema
up here. And you would have seen Lauren Taylor in Eagle vs. Shark, which I think is one of the last.
Writer, director and actor. I mean,
Writer, director and actor. And she's really talented and very promising. This is a very promising debut film.
Feature debut.
Three stars from
three
me.
Three stars. Overall,
upside down. Yeah.
Overall, Dee, how did it work or not for you?
Yeah, the story kind of went in weird directions and I felt like it could have probably afforded to go a bit darker and tragic than it ultimately did. It probably could have taken a bit more risks than I felt like it did. Tonally, I just find it kind of a weird movie experience. I'm not sure that it was all that interesting or if it really clicked for me. Maybe it's one more so for a niche audience. So 2.5 stars for me. There are some funny moments and some great performances in there though.
All right, 3.5. So a little
2.5.
I beg your pardon. I'm adding star, a whole star, 2.5, a half star less than John suggested. Okay, that's Dee Malumbi and John McGuire speaking to us about F1 the movie, with the subtitle cheesy from John for sure. Megan 2.0. It goes on general release this weekend. And The Moon is Upside Down will be at the IFI Cinema in Dublin. Thanks again to Dee Malumbi, John McGuire.
Thanks, Sean.
As Metallica prepare to embark on their highly anticipated 2026 world tour, we take a look at the band that redefined heavy metal from their thrash roots in the early 1980s to orchestral collaborations and global acclaim. Metallica's journey is one of constant reinvention and cultural impact. John Kenny is with me in studio now to explore the origins and evolutions of the band and the enduring influence they have had over four decades, which kind of seems kind of extraordinary, but not really when you think about when they were first around the place, John. 1980s, what set Metallica apart from, you know, other heavy metal artists of that period in time, that point?
Well, it would have been considered one of the big four of thrash metal. Megadeth, Dave Mustaine was the lead singer with them. He was in Metallica for a couple of years, Anthrax and Slayer. So he had that kind of combo going around the 1980s when the album Kill 'Em All came out, which was their first album released in 83, and then he went to Ride the Lightning, Master Puppets. There were the albums they released in the 80s, and that was where they were defined. Things started to change a little bit later, which we can talk about the background.
Yeah, so did Kill 'Em All really set out their stall within this thrash metal genre?
Big time. And they were young as well, you know. It's 40 years. I mean, you know, that kind of longevity is only seen like in bands like U2. And the fact that you mentioned there about their world tour coming up, I had a look at it there. They're playing some magnificent arenas around the world.
Yeah, they're playing here in Ireland as well.
They're playing here in Ireland on two dates, and it's called a no repeat for the two dates. One of the days has Pantera as well, who are a very, very good band too. Philip Anselmo, I interviewed him a couple of years ago when I was doing the metal show. But they're very much of that genre kind of too. But Metallica, we did the metal show on 2FM for about 6 years. Marcus Connaughton produced it, and we did a poll one time about the top 100 metal tracks of all times. Metallica's Enter Sandman was number one.
All right, well, let's listen to, from the very first album then, Kill 'Em All, a track called Seek and Destroy. There we go, a little bit of Seek and Destroy from Metallica's very first album, Kill 'Em All. John Kenny with me in studio this evening, looking at what Metallica did to and for heavy metal. I mean, we were saying as we were listening to that, John, essentially that first album and the next couple of albums, there wasn't a huge change in those early albums, was there, in style?
Well, when the Ride the Lightning album came out and Masters of Puppets, yes.
It was That's pretty, albums two and three,
yeah,
wasn't
two
it?
Two and three. They were pretty much the same. But you could see that things started to change. And when the Injustice for All album came out in 1988, they had a track called One. It was their first top 40 single. They produced the music video for that, and that was a really anti-war album, and it got a huge play on MTV. Remember that? MTV when they played music?
Yeah.
So that's what really kicked the band in, and then we kind of moved on to the Black album.
The Black album.
Yeah.
Let's hear Lars here. Lars, when we talk about Lars, who are we talking about?
Lars Ulrich, the drummer.
Yeah, the drummer.
And, I interviewed him with Kirk Hammett when the Load album came out. They were very reticent about doing interviews. I was very lucky to get this interview in London when the album came out in 1996. And here's actually Lars talking about the Black album and its legacy.
The staying power, it's amazing. I mean, the Black album's been out for about 5 years in about 3 months, and it's still in the top 100 in America. It still sells 10 to 15,000 copies a week to who, I have no idea. But somebody's buying it somewhere, and it's pretty interesting. I mean, the staying power of this thing and how kids seem to just, I don't know, keep latching on to what we're doing.
I mean, you really can't live in the past, and to us that's a form of living in the past. You really have to like move on and be progressive with your thinking and try not to let that, you know, influence any of the moves you make, you know, regarding the future.
There we go. The second voice you heard there, Kirk Hammett, the guitarist, rhythm guitarist with Metallica, and before that, Lars Ulrich, the drummer with Metallica, talking about the legacy of the Black Album, which was John Kenny with me talking about Metallica this evening. That was their fourth album, was it? Fifth album?
Yeah, I think it is, yeah. But it's the one that kind of just
What were they
changed.
Doing that was so different, John?
Well, we were going to play track one there in a second, but we'll just skip that by and move on to that Black Album, because that's really the quintessential album from them. They've done all that thrash metal stuff. They're getting older now. And one, that track one from Injustice for All, is the one track that pushes them into the MTV generation.
Well, do you want to listen to a little bit of one, just to get a sense of...
It's a magnificent piece of music.
Yeah, what makes it... So this is what was pushing them towards the Black Album, is what you're saying.
All, yeah.
Just starting the lyrics there, but as we were saying, John Kenny speaking to us about Metallica, we were saying as we were listening to that, it's classic metal, that, isn't it? You know, to have that big long guitar solo at the top of the track.
Yeah.
But what's most notable is that it reminded me of Apocalypse Now, you know,
it
the sound of machine gun
firing. That start could have just slotted in very nicely to Apocalypse Now, even though the album was
released
obviously a lot
later. And
this
kind of laid out that anti-war stance that they were taking, was it?
Yeah, big time. That was 88. So it's 2 years later then the Black Album comes out. It was titled Metallica. Mm. But it was a black cover and everybody called it the Black Album. And it is was 15 million copies it sold originally. And it's still selling. If you can actually look at the rock charts in the UK in particular, somewhere looking around the top 40 is the Black Album by Metallica. And the one thing about that one, just to refer back to one for a second, and the music you were playing, the guitars.
Yeah, that's the one from the that was from the album Injustice
yeah,
for All.
Yeah, it's the playing, you can say, and you were impressed by the, you know, the guitar playing at the start. When I was doing the metal show, one thing that we get, these are the days we're getting letters in, obviously there was no social media, the amount of people writing in saying I'm sitting in my bedroom learning these chords. And the one thing I found about these bands like Metallica is that young fellas and young girls as well used to mimic them in their bedrooms, and when they were listening to the show on 2FM on a Sunday night, we got a huge audience for it as well, and it was really, it was fun to do at the time, but it was great playing stuff like that and getting interviews from Metallica was something else. But I think the Black Album really defined them.
And Enter Sandman is the track that you've chosen.
That was the number one song on that 100 best metal tracks of all time, by voted by the listeners to the 2FM Metal Show.
Enter Sandman, the title of the track from the Black Album, so-called Black Album. Album was simply called Metallica, but as John Kenny has been telling us, it was always referred to as the Black Album because of the black
cover.
Scary
song. That's a scary song.
Well, the Black Album kind of says it to you.
A little story behind that as well is I got a call from the FAI a couple of years ago when I was doing the show, and they said, we need to kind of up the ante. What kind of song should we play when the teams are coming out on the pitch? And they're still playing Metallica's Enter Sandman.
There you go. There you go. They were quiet then for a while, and you addressed this in the interview that you had with
them. Yeah, that was the one thing. There was a gap then because they had released quite a lot of albums in the 80s, got to the early 90s, and then nothing until 1996. Just nothing. They just sat back and I mean, how could they beat that album? It was just an extraordinary, their number one album. Tracks on that like Enter Sandman, The Unforgiven, Sad But True. It just defined that band for a generation.
Let's listen to what Lars Ulrich, the drummer, had to say about that 5-year gap between Enter Sandman and Until It Sleeps.
That one of the best things about the 5-year thing between these records is the fact that it really did give us a chance to get that record completely out of our systems. If we had gone back to work on another record, and, you know, say somebody had said, or, you know, back to work, you know, in 1993 or something like that, it might have been a really different thing. But you got to remember, you're talking to a band who have nobody pushing them, who have nobody telling them what to do or when to do it or how to do it. And I think, you know, we definitely took some time off, and we needed to take some time off. And if we hadn't taken that time off, things could have probably turned out pretty different.
There's Lars Ulrich of Metallica speaking to John Kenny. When did you say the interview was done, John? A couple of years back?
That was done in 96 when the Load album came out.
Right, back at that time.
Before we go to the thing, Load album, they have had problems over the years as a collective, right? James Hetfield has been in and out of rehab for a drug abuse. Lars had problems himself. Obviously, Cliff Burton, the bass guitarist, died in a bus crash in 1986 as well. So they've had different people moving in and out of the band. Dave Mustaine was kicked out as well for substance abuse, but he went on to
still have what you can identify as a Metallica sound. Yeah. So we're going to finish with Until It Sleeps from the album Load. You will be there at both performances?
Well, I certainly want to go and see Pantera. I mean, they had so many albums that went in back then but it's really up to Load and Reload that us fans like. Yeah. It's that 80s stuff to the mid-90s. The rest, inconsequential. Not totally inconsequential, but good stuff is the 80s, 90s.
Well, here is a little bit of Until It Sleeps from the album, 1996 album of Metallica. Thanks for being with us this evening, John.
You're welcome, Sean.
Load. Until It Sleeps from the 1996 album Load of Metallica. John Kenny speaking to us about them. Metallica's visit to the Avivia Stadium. Two nights, as John was saying. Two different support acts, July the 19th and the 21st, 2026. You can find out full details on Ticketmaster.com. The Derry-born fashion designer Jonathan Anderson is on the cusp of showing his first collection as creative director of Dior tomorrow. He is the first person to take the helm of Dior's women's wear, Dior's men's wear and Dior's haute couture simultaneously, since Christian Dior himself, I do believe, back in the day. After a long-standing and successful stint reinventing the prestigious Spanish fashion house Loewe and designing bespoke stage outfits for the likes of Rihanna and Beyoncé, Anderson's comprehensive takeover of Dior is the apex of a career in fashion that began as a merchandiser for Prada in Brown Thomas, only down the road on Grafton Street here in Dublin. So what does it mean for an Irishman to take control of one of the most important and influential labels in fashion? Joined this evening by Penny McCormick, contributing editor at The Gloss. Putting this in context is, I think, quite difficult, Penny. How big a deal is it for a 40-year-old man from Maharafelt to be taking over the House of Dior in this kind of triple fashion that he's doing it?
I think it's huge. It's huge and something to be celebrated and enjoyed. And I hope he's actually found some space to enjoy this week. I'm sure tomorrow there's going to be a lot of nerves before he debuts his menswear. But he's got the top job in fashion. The other top job is obviously Chanel. But he's worked for it. He's got a really solid CV. And there were signs when he was growing up and at school that fashion was, you know, in his future, definitely.
Yeah. His father, of course, Willie Anderson, in his own autobiography or his own memoir, spoke about Jonathan as a young fella and how he was designing all kinds of things. I think he designed a dress for his sister at one point along the way, but that it was very clear from early on that fashion was going to be important in Jonathan Anderson's life. Jonathan himself has talked about trips to TK Maxx as a boy and an obsession with Jean-Paul Gaultier. So that this interest in fashion and talent for fashion was there from very early on and noticed by many.
Yes, that's right, including his art teacher Sharon McCracken, who recalls his A-level art, and she said he was streets ahead of his peers in terms of flair and creativity. So it's great that he had early talent, which was then cemented at the London College of Fashion and various fashion roles since then. But it also that Brown Thomas played an integral role in cementing his love of Prada. And he's mentioned Mrs. Prada and her right-hand woman, Manuela Pavese, as being instrumental in shaping his designs and aesthetic.
Yeah, and he came back to Brown Thomas in Dublin after, I think he spent a couple of years at Juilliard working studying as an actor, but he threw that to the one side. But I think that interest that wide interest in the arts, in this case acting and theatre, and I think literature is in there too, that wide interest feeds into everything he does in terms of fashion.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's what's so exciting about him. He's got such a broad range of interests. He tried acting, but realised he was more interested in costume design. Most recently, he's actually fulfilled that by, you know, designing for two films, The Challengers and Queer, which stars Daniel Craig. I think his mother, who was an English teacher, has nurtured his love of literature, which has inspired so many different collections. And he's has got a very strong interest in art as well. So he's a Renaissance man in many ways. He's got multiple interests.
Yeah, and you mentioned that the films that he designed for both Luca Guadagnini films, and in terms of The Challengers, the tennis film, there was a T-shirt in that film that suddenly, it went viral.
That's right.
And he seems to have this facility. He has it as well with the footballer Mbappe, Kylian Mbappe, the French footballer, plays for Real Madrid, where when he gives something to somebody, he seems to know who to give or who to design for, that would then pushes his products and his material out into a much wider world than the perhaps select world of haute couture.
That's right. He's got a very, he has got a talent for curating a posse of fans and ambassadors, you know, be it Rihanna or Alexa Chung or Beyonce. He designed costumes for her Renaissance tour, and also just before she died, the late actor Maggie Smith starred in one of his campaigns. So he straddles every age and enthusiasm. And the Mbappe pop-up on Instagram this week has been really exciting to see. And also he's shown his style icons have been Jean-Michel Basquiat, who might be some referenced in the collection tomorrow, and also maybe in the women's wear later on, Lee Radswell, who's the sister of Jackie O.
Yeah, and of course, exciting. and John F. Kennedy, young John Kennedy was part of what inspired that T-shirt for the Challengers.
Yes.
But given that breadth of influence and given the breadth of experience that he has at the age of 40, can you define his style? Are there emblematic qualities that, you know, yes, that's a J.W. Anderson piece?
I think he's always been known for his avant-garde collections, asymmetric cuts, interesting knitwear. He has done iron sweaters, pleats, ugly shoes, I would say, are a forte. I don't think you'd be wearing them, and I'm certainly not going to be doing grass growing out of sneakers or pointy pumps with balloon heels. But, you know, he's made very noticeable and also very covetable accessories. I mean, last year, his quirky puffin clutch bag was a viral success. And when he was at Loewe, the puzzle bag was, he made it a contemporary classic. It's very pricey, but, you know, definitely I think most fashionistas would want one in their wardrobe.
Yeah.
So he has got an eye for detail and for what will work and what will fly off the shelves, because he's quadrupled the profits at Loewe. So I'm sure that's what Dior are hoping for as well.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, but you've answered it there in many ways. To what extent was that's the success he had with Loewe, who there's this Spanish leather house, I think, for the most part, leather goods that they deal in. He seems to have just transformed that business into, as you say, a huge multi-million dollar success. Is there pressure on him then to perform at Dior in that way, in the business sense of things as well as everything else?
Absolutely. I mean, he takes over from Maria Grazia Chiuri, who was a huge success. She has not left the house in disarray by any means. She also has done very well commercially with lots of different bags and shoes and collections. But there's a lot of pressure for Jonathan to maintain that success. When he took over Loewe, it was described as the Spanish Hermes. So it was a very kind of discreet, aristocratic brand. But he turned it into a cultural brand as much as a fashion brand. And I think he will maintain that kind of philosophy at Dior. We'll see his passions. He said for Loewe, his ideal customer is an art enthusiast. So I'm pretty sure that he'll maintain that at Dior. But the real pressure is on. I mean, he has to prove himself.
Yeah, and yet within all of that haute couture side of things, he seems to be able to manage stuff for the high street as well. Topshop and Uniqlo, I think.
Yes.
Uniqlo would be a kind of a high street brand rather than a haute couture brand.
Yes, I don't know where he finds the time. It's obviously the more you do, the more you can do. But he has been very successful. And then last year, he did a fun kind of limited edition range for Guinness. He did a couple of T-shirts with a smiley pint on them. And he's been very clever at doing capsule collections for high street brands, as well as keeping up the high-end design.
We should point out, given that one of the big pieces of news from the world of fashion today is Anna Wintour deciding that she is now moving on for Vogue. I think she has praised him very highly in the past. I think it's only been announced on social media in the last couple of hours, as far as I'm aware.
Yes, I was just reading it before I came on air. I think it's been brewing, to be honest. There's been a few things going on in the background that she's been consistently under fire for, but not detracting from her 37 years, you know, as editor-in-chief of the fashion magazine. She's achieved a lot. But anyone she gives the nod to is going to be successful.
Absolutely.
You know, we can
presume and hope that Jonathan will be successful. Jonathan Anderson will be successful at Dior. And it's a bit soon to be talking about where does he go to from there. But where does he go to from there if he is a success?
Chanel, probably.
Yeah. You know, is it the epitome, really? Is it a slight bit above Dior in that respect?
Maybe, but very slight. I think both roles. I actually almost preferred Dior. I mean, I've loved Yves Saint Laurent and John Galliano and Gianfranco Ferri's tenureship at Dior, So I think it's a really exciting role, and one that he'll want to stay in for quite a while. I mean, he stayed at Loewe for almost, 11 years? So I think he's going to be there for
a while. That's absolutely great. Penny, thanks for being with us. And that's Penny speaking to us about Jonathan, or J.W. Anderson, whichever you want to call him, the fashion designer who takes over. Penny McCormick speaking to us about Jonathan Anderson, takes over Dior in all three roles, women's wear, men's wear and haute couture. And that is our lot for this Thursday evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields researched. John Byrne was the broadcast coordinator. Jamie Doyle was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Reg Luby. Back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock here on RT Radio 1. John Crean will be with you after the news.